making TV special.
Venice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Here Comes the Fear Again, music from Pulp. My name's James Evan Pilato, and you're clicked into the B-side of episode 109 of MediaMonarchy.com. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and the show, Media Monarchy, bringing you all the news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups that your brain can handle. Tons to go over here on this B-side, coming to you from my apartment in downtown Portland, Oregon, a little bit after 9 in the evening, and it's Thursday, February 5th in the year of our Lord, 2009. First up, it's EnviroHealth, it's corn syrup, mercury, vaccines, and carbon bullprint. First up from Health Day News by way, helpfully, from the Washington Post. Study finds high fructose corn syrup contains mercury. That's right. HFCS with a little bit of mercury. Again, from Health Day News. Almost half of tested samples of commercial high fructose corn syrup contained mercury, which was also found in nearly a third of 55 popular brand name food and beverage products where high fructose corn syrup is the first or second highest labeled ingredient, according to not one, but two new U.S. studies. HFCS has replaced sugar as the sweetener in many beverages and foods such as bread, cereals, breakfast bars, lunch meats, yogurt, soups, and condiments. On average, Americans consume about 12 teaspoons per day of HFCS, but teens and other high consumers can take in 80% more high fructose than average. Mercury is a toxin in all its forms. Given how much high fructose corn syrup is consumed by children, it could be a significant additional source of mercury never before considered. We're calling for immediate changes by industry and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, to help stop this avoidable mercury contamination of the food supply, said the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy's Dr. David Walinga, a co-author of both the studies. In the first study, published in the current issue of Environmental Health, researchers found detectable levels of mercury in 9 of 20 samples of commercial HFCS, and in the second study, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, a nonprofit watchdog group, found that nearly 1 in 3 of 55 brand-name foods contained mercury. The chemicals found most commonly in HFCS containing dairy products, dressings, and condiments. Now, for you, the PDF links and otherwise to Not So Sweet, Missing Mercury in High Fructose Corn Syrup, PDF, Much High Fructose Corn Syrup Contaminated with Mercury, the Environmental Health article, as well as Dr. Walinga on Democracy Now. So, PDFs, audio, video, peer-reviewed journals, and research for you. Going along with this nicely, fortunately, someone put up a clip, mercury found in corn syrup. One, unfortunately, they misspelled mercury, M-U-R-C-U-R-Y, and unfortunately on YouTube now they add that headline, so as I'm scrolling down it looks, I see this terrible typo that I can't help. However, it's a good, informative little video, but importantly, it starts with this amazing commercial.
You want a bite?
I thought you loved me.
I do. Take two bites.
It's got high fructose corn syrup in it.
So?
Well, you know what they say about it.
What?
That it's...
That it's made from corn, has the same calories as sugar, honey, and it's fine in moderation.
You only brought one?
Get the facts. You're in for a sweet surprise.
That's just one of the numerous amazing media propaganda memes flying around right now. We're going to get into a lot of them tomorrow on episode 110 of Media Monarchy, of course, on the Portland Radio Authority. But that's just a taste. That's just a taste of some of the TV propaganda. But staying right on topic with that, coming from Alex Jones and InfoWars, vaccines and other government propaganda. I'm not going to play the clip, but in the seventh installment of his new audio blog, Alex Jones and his wife, Violet, discuss various government propaganda as well as television programs, which advance the idea that those who don't vaccinate will contaminate the rest of society. Violet Jones discusses an episode of the show Private Practice, which features a scenario where the mother of an autistic child had refused to vaccinate another child out of concern about the link between the vaccine and autism. That action is portrayed as a dangerous misjudgment leading to the second child spreading measles, which the doctors see as evidence that the woman's children should be taken by CPS. It's interesting in this clip to hear someone other than Alex talking on InfoWars. So it's his wife, Violet, talking about Private Practice, and there's links for you. You can read about the episode, and the clip is very good. Wrapping up this EnviroHealth posting, however, jumping across the pond to the Times Online, it's nice base irony. Again, like Bill Hicks would say, it's a hoot. Carbon calculating supercomputer has its own huge carbon footprint. For the Met Office, the forecast is considerable embarrassment. It spent £33 million on a new supercomputer to calculate how climate change will affect Britain, only to find the new machine has a giant carbon footprint of its own. The new supercomputer, which will become operational later this year, will emit 14,400 tons of CO2 a year, said David Britton, the Met Office's chief press officer. That's equivalent to the CO2 emitted by 2,400 homes, generating an average of 6 tons each year. The Met Office recently published, with a link for you, some of its most drastic predictions for future climate change. It warned, quote, if no action is taken to curb global warming, temperatures are likely to rise by blah-bitty-blah-bitty-blah. The links are there. You can follow it. It's just nice, basic irony that I thought we'd throw out, of course, like global warming conferences being snowed out and the like. A different posting, but staying on topic, it's all the same story. Water bankruptcy and a two-child policy. First, the water bankruptcy from the AFP, and the first little bit to drip out from Davos onto MediaMonarchy.com. World heads for water bankruptcy, says Davos report. The world is heading towards water bankruptcy as demand for the precious commodity outstrips even high population growth. In less than 20 years, water scarcity could lose the equivalent of the entire grain crop of India and the United States, said the World Economic Forum report, linked up for you, PDF 4.5 megs, which added that food demand is expected to skyrocket in coming decades as well. The world simply cannot manage water in the future in the same way as in the past, or the economic web will collapse, said the report. Water has been consistently underpriced in many regions and has been wasted and overused. Many places in the world are on the verge of water bankruptcy following a series of regional water bubbles over the past 50 years. Now, to the two-child policy, two children should be the limit, says green guru Jonathan Porritt. Couples who have more than two children are being irresponsible by creating an unbearable burden on the environment, the government's green advisor has warned. That would be the UK. Jonathan Porritt, P-O-R-R-I-T-T, who chairs the government's Sustainable Development Commission, sd-commission.org.uk, says curbing population growth through contraception and abortion must be at the heart of policies to fight global warming. He says political leaders and green campaigners should stop dodging the issues of environmental harm caused by an expanding population. A report by the commission to be published next month will say that governments must reduce population growth through better family planning. More abortions. Abortions for all. Boo. Abortions for no one. Boo. Abortions for some. Miniature American flags for the others. Yeah. Let's jump to the econo crash. As again, it's all related. It's all the same story. It's all the attack on the consciousness. Econo crash, unemployment, bank closures, survivalism, and logic bombs. first from independent.co.uk. Beijing rocked by 26 million lost jobs. An estimated 26 million poor rural Chinese are now without jobs after pinning their hopes on the once booming manufacturing sector, where work has dried up due to the global economic slowdown, a government advisory body said. The figure was released one day after Beijing warned of possibly the toughest year since the turn of the century, calling for the development of agriculture and rural areas to offset the economic fallout. Though many Chinese cities have seen double-digit growth in recent years, the countryside has lagged behind, forcing peasants to seek urban factory jobs. A recent government survey showed that more than 15% of China's 130 million migrant workers have returned to their hometowns recently, where they are now unemployed. Another 5 to 6 million new migrants enter the workforce each year. So if we put those figures together, we have roughly 25 to 26 million rural migrant workers who are now coming under pressures for employment. 26 million. From Bloomberg, banks close in Florida, Maryland, and Utah. So back in the States, banks in Florida, Maryland, and Utah were closed on January 30th, as regulators wrapped up the busiest month for failure since the housing slump began in 06. Ocala National Bank in Florida and Suburban Federal Savings Bank of Crofton, Maryland were shut by federal regulators, according to statements sent by the FDIC. Magnet Bank of Salt Lake City was seized by the Utah Department of Financial Institutions. The banks had total assets of $876 million and deposits of $790 million. Six banks have failed this month as tumbling home prices and a 16-year high in unemployment boost foreclosures. The FDIC has classified 171 banks as problems in the third quarter, a 46% jump from the previous period amidst the worst housing crisis since the Great Depression. And I believe that month they were talking about was the month of January. From Reuters to the protest of the Davos World Economic Forum, where the banksters and gangsters and world globalist elite gather. You, that is them, you're the crisis. Protesters rally against World Economic Forum. Again, from Reuters, hundreds of people rallied in Geneva and Davos to protest against the World Economic Forum, saying the elite gathered for its annual meeting are not qualified to fix the world's problems. Carrying banners reading, "You are the crisis," and throwing snowballs, several hundred protesters marched to fences surrounding the heavily guarded Hotel Seehof in the Davos ski resort, where many world leaders and business people stay during the forum. Protester Alex Heidegger, a member of the Davos Green Party, said these were the people to blame for the economic mess. "It's the same people who came last year and said the world economic situation is fine, and now we're in a financial crisis. Now it's the taxpayer who has to solve the whole problem. It's people like you and me who have to pay for it with their tax money." Elites. Calls the problem, offer the fake solution that they wanted in the first place. Booms and busts. They create it. They claim that they're the only ones that can stop it. So whether it's the Federal Reserve or whatever new bailout or new TARP or new stimulus or bullshit is going down, it's not going to help you. We're going to see, again, throughout all this, the idea of the breaking down of other countries, and again, as we've talked about Iceland and Greece, we're going to see these things start to happen here. And although those are small countries, we're a large country made up of small states, so we're going to start to see California go bankrupt. God knows what's going on in Kentucky right now with ice storms and sick, tainted FEMA food. And the recalls, which, Jesus, each day at the store where I work, there's something new we're getting rid of. It started out with an energy bar or two with some peanut butter. Now it's pulling the bulk roasted peanuts to make peanut butter and all that. It's the breakdown. Breaking us down to build us up into something else. from Raw Story, survivalists, left of center, now joining our growing movement. Growing being the pun. One-time preserve of anti-establishment loners, cultists, and gun nuts has gone mainstream. Sick of worrying about the future? Then spare a thought for Jim Rawls. Rawls, 48, is one of a rising number of survivalists. Americans hunkering down for what they predict will be a nightmare of economic failure, mass terrorism, pandemics, and social chaos. The movement's definitely growing, Rawls, manager of the site survivalblog.com, told the AFP by telephone from what he described as a survival-ready ranch somewhere west of the Rockies. Survivalists have a long history in the United States, but what used to be the preserve of anti-establishment loners, cultists, and gun nuts has gone mainstream. Government agencies are encouraging citizens to prepare evacuation plans and food supplies in case of myriad disasters. So, you used to be a kook. I think, as I'm thinking this out right now, you used to be the kook. And you used to be the one ridiculed on Donahue and the talk shows that you were just playing G.I. Joe, and worse, that you were a white supremacist or God knows what. I've said before, too, that now that we shift back into the fake Democrat posture, it's going to shift like we saw in the Clinton era, where the enemies are going to be the McVeighs and the Wacos and the homegrown terrorism and the violent radicalization of people whose society has fallen apart. Left of center now joining the growing survivalist movement. Lastly, on this Econo Crash posting, unemployment, bank closures, survivalism, it's time for the logic bombs. Feds allege logic bomb plot to destroy Fannie Mae data. From the Associated Press, as well as many links to Threat Level and CRN.com, the Justice Department, if we can call it that, says it foiled a plot by a fired Fannie Mae contract worker in Maryland to destroy all the data on the mortgage giant's 4,000 computer servers nationwide. The U.S. Attorney's Office says 35-year-old Rajin Drazin Makwana of Glen Allen, Virginia, is scheduled for arraignment last Friday in U.S. District Court in Baltimore on one count of computer intrusion. U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein says Makwana was fired October 24th. Rosenstein said that on that day, Makwana programmed a computer with a malicious code that was set to spread throughout the Fannie Mae network and destroy all data. And it was supposed to happen, I believe, last Saturday. Makwana's federal public defender did not immediately return a call seeking comment. Washington-based Fannie Mae is the largest U.S. mortgage finance company. I've mentioned some of the strange synchronicities and things and being tapped in to what's being put out there. I think I made brief references to the strange inaugural Bible Chester A. Arthur Simpson's meme. The word mortgage, of course, break it down. Mort, that means death. You pay until you die. My girlfriend and I had keyed in on that word later that afternoon, not probably an hour later. I'm listening to Visigoth, and he says the exact same thing. It's amazing, as maybe it all does become somehow more clear. So, to not just me and you, but to more and more and more and more people. Let's jump now to the second Econo Crash posting, and I actually just put this up just a few minutes before we started this B-Side 109, so this comes from today, February 5th, and there's all sorts of things in here. Econo Crash Hack and Slash. First, Goldman and JP Morgan not affected by executive salary caps. again from Bloomberg, executives at Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and hundreds of other financial institutions receiving federal aid aren't likely to be affected by pay restrictions announced yesterday by Obamasiya. There's a link there for you. Of course, he announced this big pay cap for executives. Ooh. There's a link to the Telegraph for you. The rules created in response to growing public anger about the record bonuses the financial industry doled out last year will apply only to top executives at countries that need exceptional assistance in the future. The limits aren't retroactive, meaning firms that have already taken government money won't be subject to the restrictions unless they have to come back for more. So the biggies grab their dough and ran. Take the money and run. And usually what we see now happening with Goldman and J.P. Morgan, or guys from the Federal Reserve, is they take that money and they run to their new government appointment or cabinet or staff position with the Obamasiya. Front man for Wall Street, Soros, Brzezinski, gangster banksters. From Threat Level again, and a video I stole from my foxny.com and posted up to youtube.com/mediamonarchy.com. Global ATM caper nets hackers $9 million in one day.
You're looking at security video obtained by Fox 5 of a small piece of a huge scam that took place all in one day in a matter of hours. According to the FBI, ATMs from 49 cities were hit, including Atlanta, Chicago, New York, Montreal, Moscow, and Hong Kong. This is FBI agent Ross Rice.
We've seen similar attempts to defraud a bank through ATM machines, but not anywhere near the scale we have here.
These are believed to be suspected cashers, low-level players in a scheme devised from a mastermind, a dangerous computer hacker. Hacking ring they fear could strike again. Here's how it all came down, according to information we obtained from the FBI and law enforcement sources. The computer system for a company called RBS WorldPay was hacked. One service the company provides is the ability for employers to pay employees with money going directly to a card called a payroll card, a lot like a debit card that can be used in any ATM machine. The hacker was able to infiltrate the supposedly secure system and steal the information necessary to duplicate or clone people's ATM card.
We've never seen one this well coordinated.
Then, shortly after midnight Eastern Time on November 8th, the FBI believes that dozens of the so-called cashers were used in a coordinated attack of ATM machines around the world.
Over 130 ATM machines in 49 different cities worldwide were accessed within a 30-minute period on November 8th. So you can get an idea of the number of people that were involved in this and the scope of the operation.
Now, here's the amazing part. With these cashers ready to do their dirty work around the world, the hacker somehow had the ability to lift those limits we all have on our ATM cards. For example, I'm only allowed to take out $500 a day, but the cashers were able to go in, take money out again and again and again. The total ripped off, $9 million. The RBS website says that cardholders will not be responsible for any unauthorized transactions, but there is fear that the hackers might have had access to sensitive information used in identity theft. We're talking about 1.5 million customers being affected. Some of them had their social security numbers jeopardized.
The number of machines that were accessed, the number of cities that were targeted, and the number of people that had to be involved in this is quite significant.
Investigators are hoping a break in the case may come from one of the cashers. The theory is they probably were recruited, paid a small fee to be soldiers in the scam, and might be likely to rat out the people who hired them.
There are millions of people out there these days with these payroll cards, and RBS says they have sent out letters to anyone who might have been affected. They are also offering one-year credit protection for anyone whose social security number may have been jeopardized by this scam. However, the good news is it doesn't look like any identity theft has occurred yet. I'm John Dutzman, Fox 5 News.
Well, so far, the FBI has no suspects and has made no arrests in the scam. An attorney in Atlanta has filed a class action lawsuit against RBS WorldPay for allegedly failing to protect personal information. Now, RBS WorldPay tells Fox 5 that they have hired a security firm to try to figure out exactly what happened and to prevent it from happening again.
That was the hack-in. It's time for the slash-in. First from Wikinews, Scandinavian airline system to cut 8,600 jobs. Sweden-based airline Scandinavian Airline Systems, SAS, said it will reduce payrolls by 8,600 jobs as part of its core SAS restructuring plan. The airline will cut 3,000 staff directly and eliminate 5,600 by divesting business ventures, reducing the workforce by 40% to 14,000. Next, from the AP, Macy's to cut 7,000 jobs and slash dividends as well. Retailer Macy's says it'll cut 7,000 jobs or 4% of its workforce and slash its dividend as it looks to lower expenses. Cincinnati-based Macy's says the workforce reduction includes positions in offices, stores, and other locations. The cuts will include some unfilled jobs. Again from the AP, Panasonic to cut 15,000 jobs and shut plants. Panasonic Corporation, sinking into its first annual loss in 6 years, said Wednesday it was slashing about 15,000 jobs and shuttering 27 plants worldwide, joining a string of Japanese companies making deep cuts as they cope with the global slowdown. From Raw Story, as well as from the AFP, IBM, International Business Machines, the final solutions company. IBM invites laid-off U.S. employees to come work for them in India. Redefining the possibilities of the word offshore, IBM has invited its recently laid-off U.S. workers to find work with the storied company in developing countries like India, where salaries are a fraction of what Americans are used to. While the invitation is likely more than most U.S. companies have offered the 2.6 million Americans laid off in 2008, the company's standing offers probably cold comfort to most newly minted ex-IBM employees. From the Washington Times, as you see, we'll see more bizarre, desperate acts, whether it's put an RFID skimmer in an ATM trying to scam money, or the ATM hacking that we just heard about, or even the strange things that I'm still wondering about the motive, the strange bank bombing we had here in Oregon just a couple of months ago, where, if you'll recall, the bomb experts brought the bomb into the bank where it exploded. And unfortunately, two officers died. Strange, desperate things. Anthrax hoax linked to market losses. A New Mexico man sent dozens of threatening letters in an anthrax hoax to Chase Bank and government agencies as revenge for money he said he lost in the stock market because of the current financial crisis. Richard Leon Goyette, G-O-Y-E-T-T-E, 47 years old, was arrested last Monday on charges of sending 65 threatening letters, 64 of which contained a white powder that was later determined to be non-hazardous. Makes you wonder why one was empty of the powder. Finally, by way of Cryptagon and by way of Creedler-Net.de, it's the financial collapse put to music. Melodies derived from stock charts arranged with Songsmith, the Microsoft composition tool. This is by a guy named Johannes Creedler. We'll be right back. the financial crash put to music, or more literally, music made from the crashing stock charts of companies. You should watch the video and you'll see which companies they're going along with as you watch the arrow point down. You'll notice there's a lot of descending melodies there by Creedler. But let's jump from economy crash to the geopolitics, or perhaps the cause to some of the effects. Geopolitics, occupation, colonization, assimilation. First, from globalresearch.ca, Italians occupy site of proposed U.S. military base in Vicenza. Opposition to what would be a major new hub for the U.S. military in Europe is not new. Protest marches have filled Vicenza's streets. The Italian prime minister has lost his job, but now construction has neared and protesters have occupied the site to prevent it. There is a link for you to read more background on Vicenza after downingstreet.org/Vicenza. That's V-I-C-E-N-Z-A. So, on the morning of January 31st at about 10 in the morning, the movement opposing the new U.S. base in Vicenza, Italy, entered and occupied the site. The police were caught completely off guard and the activists were able to cut the fence and gates and occupy the area. Once the police arrived, they were planning to forcibly remove the protesters. However, the protesters are occupying an area that was the airport Dal Molin, which is technically under control of the Italian Civilian Aviation Authority, ENAC, who has said the protest is legitimate. So far, the police have backed off. So, that night, there was a public assembly, followed by a dinner and a concert, and this was basically the start of a week of protest that was set to start on February 2nd, and it basically looks like the activists got off to an early start. The links in there will give you the backstory of this base, and of course, its tie-in with the GWAT. A strange one from onlinejournal.com, Wayne Madsen: Israel hopes to colonize parts of Iraq as Greater Israel. However, let's jump to Danger Room. Doctors spooked by Israel's mystery weapon. Critics continue to press the case that Israel committed war crimes in its war with Hamas because of the civilian casualties in Gaza. Ironically, many of these wounds have been caused by a weapon designed to reduce collateral damage. Not that the Israelis admit they have the thing. Danger Room first reported on dense, inert metal explosives, dime munitions, in 2006. There are a large number of reports from Gaza that suggest this type of weapon has been used and unfortunately caused civilian deaths. There are reports and pictures of victims peppered with small particles and descriptions which are consistent with very localized blasts. Eric Fossey, a Norwegian doctor working in Gaza, says that the weapon causes the tissue to be torn from the flesh. It looks very different from a shrapnel injury. I've seen and treated a lot of different injuries for the last 30 years in different war zones, and this looks completely different. According to Fossey and his colleague Mads Gilbert, who we've noted before has been out from the very beginning of this latest Gaza adventure, saying that Israelis targeting civilians. According to Fossey and his colleague Mads Gilbert, the weapon typically amputates or tears apart lower limbs and patients often don't survive. It's no more illegal than normal blast and shrapnel weapon, but it is a mystery. Mystery weapons. Thanks to your tax dollars. That is, if you're here in the North American Union. However, let's jump to The Guardian, and we mentioned Iceland. They're, of course, now going to be assimilated into the European Union. Breaking it down, breaking its back, you will be assimilated into the pack.
Been severely hit by the, particularly by the financial meltdown in the banking sector over recent months, with unprecedented scenes of riots in the streets of Reykjavik, you know, riot police being deployed, and the first government to fall, certainly in Europe, and directly as a result of economic meltdown and financial crash. So this week, Geir Harde, the Prime Minister Conservative, whose, you know, his party has been running Iceland for 18 years, has stand down. Prime Minister standing down has also been diagnosed with cancer. And in the meantime, we're getting a caretaker government of Social Democrats and Greens, a set of left government, until new elections can be staged. And the Social Affairs Minister, the leader of the Social Democrats, is the new Prime Minister, is an openly gay woman. So that's another first for Iceland. Unprecedented times up in the Arctic.
And how might Iceland pull itself back from the brink?
Well, one rescue plan that's being mooted at the moment is a fast track straight into the European Union. Basically, there will be an election, a general election in Iceland, probably in May, but sometime between April and June. And a cycle to just kind of restore confidence in the whole system, a psychological kind of, you know, support for a society that has hit the rails. One solution being mooted is to join the European Union, and more particularly to join the single currency, the euro. Basically, the Icelandic currency, the krona, has been wrecked by the financial crash. It's currently worth less than half the value it was several months ago. Pensions have been destroyed, been wiped out, savings and so on and so forth. And it's a tiny country, a small country, and in fact it's the smallest country and smallest economy in the world with its own independent currency. That currency is effectively now dead, according to very senior Icelandic officials, and the only way out of this mess is to get themselves a new currency, and the only option therefore with a new currency is the euro, particularly since the Icelandic economy is so integrated into the European economy. In any case, it only makes sense to go that way. So all of a sudden, both in Brussels and in Reykjavik, political leaders and policymakers are talking about joining the European Union. The word is that a formal application to join the EU could be made before the summer. Whether it comes before the election or after the election remains to be seen. If that application is made, it would be fast-tracked because it would be quite easy to integrate Iceland into the European Union, and it already basically conforms to a lot of the legislation, a lot of the bureaucratic procedures that are involved in joining.
Iceland will be put on a fast track to joining the European Union to rescue the small Arctic state from financial collapse amid rising expectations that it'll apply for membership within months, senior policymakers in Brussels and Reykjavik have told The Guardian. The European Commission is preparing itself for a membership bid depending on the outcome of a snap general election expected in May. An application would be viewed very favorably in Brussels, and the negotiations, which normally take many years, would be fast-forwarded to make Iceland the EU's 29th member in record time, probably in 2011. You will be assimilated. From the Asia Times, Chinese state media goes global, as of course all the states go global with their propaganda, even as the People's Liberation Army, PLA, is projecting hard power across the four corners of the earth. The Chinese Communist Party, CCP, is mapping out a multi-pronged strategy to publicize globally the apparent viability of the quote-unquote China model. The administration of President Hu Jintao is spending around 45 billion yuan to boost what party insiders call overseas propaganda. Prominent state media, including the appropriately named CCTV and Xinhua News Agency, will vastly enhance programs and news feeds in different languages for Western and Asian audiences, and an English news channel modeled on Al Jazeera is set to let the world get the Chinese take on issues and events ranging from politics and finance to culture and religion. Chinese state media goes global. A nice update, a positive drug story, if you will. We hit this, I believe, a few months ago in November, when the Bolivian president says that the DEA encourages drug running. They're out. From the UPI, DEA quits Bolivia on Evo Morales's order. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration has removed all its agents from Bolivia, complying with orders by President Evo Morales. The DEA began pulling agents out several weeks ago, and the last agents left last Thursday, the Los Angeles Times reported the link. The development comes even as Bolivian officials say coca cultivation and cocaine processing are growing. Morales ordered the DEA out in November, more than three decades after the DEA began working there. He expelled U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg last year, and the Bush administration has decertified Bolivia's anti-drug campaign. Citing senior law enforcement officials, The Times reported this is the first time the DEA has been ordered to pull its entire operation out of a country. Officials said DEA personnel would be redeployed to bordering countries where they could monitor developments in Bolivia. He basically said the truth. Like a lot of these situations, they calls and help the running. I don't even have the flashbacks posted up of, you know, border agents or drug interdiction guys being involved in running the drugs themselves. It's an age-old story. The amazing move, however, is kicking these guys out and basically saying, you guys help the drug running and the drug profiteering and the whole phony war on drugs bullshit. Almost said war on terror. It's the same exact bullshit. You can't win. And everywhere you look, you'll see more. From Wikinews, North Korea cancels military and political agreements with South Korea. According to media reports in North Korea, the government has severed all political and military ties with its neighbor, South Korea. The North also canceled cooperation, non-aggression, and reconciliation agreements that were agreed upon in the early 1990s.
The Korean Central News Agency, the official mouthpiece of the Pyongyang regime, released a statement Friday declaring that North Korea will no longer honor political and military agreements between the two Koreas. The remarks, coming from the North Committee for the Peaceful Reunification of Korea, say Pyongyang will also scrap accords regarding the North's border with South Korea in the Yellow Sea. This site was the scene of bloody clashes between the two Koreas in 1999 and 2002. The statement also accused South Korea of pushing the two countries to the brink of war. Seoul has so far responded by urging Pyongyang to engage in dialogue. The South Korean Ministry of Unification released a statement read by spokesperson Kim Song-mi.
We, the South Korean government, express our deep regret for the claims North Korea made today to nullify all agreements regarding the political current military confrontational status and to scrap all articles of inter-Korean agreements regarding the maritime demarcation line. All inter-Korean agreements can be revised only through mutual consent and can never be abandoned by unilateral demand of one side.
The South Korean military was already on heightened alert when earlier this month North Korea threatened to adopt an all-out confrontational posture. Pyongyang has criticized the policies of conservative South Korean President Lee Myung-bak, who it calls a traitor to the reunification of the two nations. Since taking office last year, President Lee has withheld much of the economic aid that was offered to Pyongyang by his two liberal predecessors, saying North Korea must dismantle its nuclear program in exchange for the aid. Many analysts here see North Korea's increasingly bellicose rhetoric as its way of trying to intimidate Seoul to resume financial support. Lee Chung-min, dean of Yonsei University's Graduate School of International Studies, believes these threats indicate instability within the Kim Jong-il regime itself.
I think the primary audience for North Korea's announcement that they were going to enter into a period of hostilities with South Korea was directed at North Korea's own population. Given the fact that there is lots of uncertainty surrounding Kim Jong-il's regime, I believe that the regime's ability to maintain political control is basically ebbing.
Pyongyang's hostile remarks coincide with speculation that leader Kim Jong-il has chosen one of his three sons to take over after his death. Kim, who turned 68 in February, is believed to have suffered a stroke in 2008. North and South Korea technically remain at war because they never signed a peace treaty to end the 1950 to 1953 Korean conflict. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
The report comes as the Committee for the Peaceful Reunification of Korea, CPRK, was quoted as saying that the South reduced North Korea to dead documents, pushing the two to the brink of a war. All the agreed points concerning the issue of putting an end to the political and military confrontation between the North and the South will be nullified. said the CPRK in a statement, which also said that there is no hope of improving relations. They have reached the extreme point where the clash of fire against fire, steel against steel, has become inevitable. A spokesman for the Reunification Ministry of South Korea, Kim Ho-nyon, says the South Korean government deeply regrets the decisions made by the North. There are many links in there, thanks to Wikinews and Voice of America News, as well as the BBC and Khalij Times, as well as the New York Times, and on and on. BBC won't play this Gaza aid appeal. The BBC has been joined by Sky News in their boycott of this aid appeal for the children of Gaza, but you can watch it on YouTube as the Disasters Emergency Committee at dec.org.uk has posted the ad that the BBC and Sky News won't play.
The children of Gaza are suffering. Many are struggling to survive. Homeless and in need of food and water. Today, this is not about the rights and wrongs of the conflict. These people simply need your help. Several hundred have been killed in Gaza in recent weeks. A large number of them have been children. Some of those who have survived are traumatized from the loss of loved ones. UK aid agencies report that 60% of the population is now living in poverty. Thousands are malnourished, with more than 1 million dependent on aid to survive. And the UN says the number of homeless is in the thousands, with 300,000 people without access to running water. As residents here return to the rubble which used to be their homes, the scale of the devastation is only now becoming evident. Entire streets have been flattened, and in some areas, Gaza looks like it's been hit by an earthquake. Aid workers on the ground say that temporary shelters are finding it difficult to cope with the number of people now living on the streets. The UN reports that 40% of the population are without electricity, causing a virtual collapse of the sewage system and creating additional public health risk. The hospitals have been overwhelmed with the number of casualties and need more resources to treat them. This is why the DEC has launched this appeal on behalf of its members. They just want to help save lives. They are already working on the ground, but need more money as supplies are running short. So please, donate now. You can give online by going to our website at www.dec.org.uk or donate by telephone at our 24-hour automated credit or debit card line. Please call now on 03 70 60 60 900. That's 03 70 60 60 900. Or you can donate over the counter at any post office. Just £25 can provide blankets for 8 children, £50 can pay for food for a family for 1 month, and £100 will provide a tarpaulin and a kit for a temporary shelter. Please, act now. This region may be used to violence, but many of these children are not. Whatever you are able to give, every pound will make a difference to their survival and help avoid a worsening humanitarian disaster. Thank you.
Finally, on this geopolitics posting, occupation, colonization, assimilation, a quick funny note to Wikinews, confusion over British cannabis status. I don't know if this counts as a positive drug story, but there's basically a misunderstanding about the current British cannabis status, and they're trying to figure out what to charge people with and how it all works. So that article is there from Wikinews. However, we're going to now jump to the second geopolitics posting. And again, I posted this up today on February 5th. Geopolitics closing bases and launching satellites. First from the Associated Press, Kyrgyzstan is closing a key U.S. base. That, of course, that base is key to the Afghan conflict. Again, another example of countries basically figuring out what side they're on. Kyrgyzstan's president said Tuesday his country's ending U.S. use of an airbase key to military operations in Afghanistan, a decision with potentially grave consequences for U.S. efforts to put down surging Taliban and al-Qaeda violence. A U.S. military official in Afghanistan called President Kurmanbekiev's statement political positioning and denied the U.S. presence at the Manas Air Base would end anytime soon. The United States is preparing to deploy an additional 15,000 troops in Afghanistan and Manas, that's M-A-N-A-S, Air Base. Starting again, the United States is preparing to deploy, of course, by the Obamasiah and his buddy Gates, deploying an additional 15,000 troops in Afghanistan and Manas as an important stopover for U.S. material and personnel. Ending U.S. access would be a significant victory for Moscow in its efforts to squeeze the United States out of Central Asia, home to substantial oil and gas reserves, and seen by Russia as part of its strategic sphere of influence. Kyrgyz President Kurmanbekbakiev spoke on a visit to Moscow minutes after Russia announced it was providing the poor Central Asian nation with billions of dollars in aid. Bakiev said when the U.S. forces began using the Manas after 9/11, the expectation was that that would last for 2 years at most. Links in there to the Telegraph, as well as some Wikipedia entries to read more about Kyrgyz President Kurmanbekbakiev, that's B-A-K-I-Y-E-V, and more on the sphere of influence and political posturing from the Christian Science Monitor. However, always good work from Russia Today. Kyrgyzstan to shut key NATO base.
It's the decision the Russian media predicted. Now the official word is out. The U.S. military is no longer welcome at the Manas base. Since 2001, the airport near the capital Bishkek has been home to a 1,000-strong American airbase as Kyrgyzstan joined the anti-terror coalition set up after 9/11. The base provided backup support for NATO troops in Afghanistan. It also brought much-needed cash to the impoverished country. Its value to the Kyrgyz economy is estimated at $150 million a year. But President Bakiyev said the Americans have stayed too long and did not pay enough.
Initially, it was a question of 1 or 2 years, but 8 years have passed. We have repeatedly raised the issue of economic compensation for the existence of the base in Kyrgyzstan with our American partners, but we have not been understood.
The once warm welcome has chilled after incidents between locals and military personnel. There have been reports of fights with the local population. In one incident, two women were run over in Bishkek by a vehicle driven by a U.S. serviceman. In another, a Kyrgyz citizen was shot dead by an American soldier who escaped prosecution due to immunity enjoyed by U.S. military at the base. But U.S. officials say they are hoping for future use of the base.
It is a hugely important airbase for us. It provides us with a launching off point to provide supplies to our forces in Afghanistan. We are hopeful we can continue our good relationship with the Kyrgyz government and can continue to use Manas in support of our operations in Afghanistan.
With Washington vowing to boost the war effort in Afghanistan, the closure is bad news.
The base is very significant. We all know that it ensures from the north air cover for operations which are not just U.S. and not just NATO. It's an international operation against the terrorist organizations inside Afghanistan, specifically the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Russia, along with China and Kyrgyzstan's neighbors, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, has long supported the closure. Kyrgyzstan also hosts a Russian military base on its territory. After the talks, President Medvedev said Moscow will grant Bishkek a $2 billion package of loans and write off part of Kyrgyzstan's debt to Russia.
We have a special relationship with Kyrgyzstan. It's unprecedented support in times of financial crisis, but it's a strategic decision that's in the interests of both Russia and Kyrgyzstan.
As Kyrgyzstan looks to have cooled towards Washington, friendship with Russia is warmly embraced.
For years, Kyrgyzstan has been walking a fine line in its dealings with Moscow and Washington. Now, whether it's harsh economic realities or ideology, it's made its choice. Svetlana Kurakina, RT, Moscow.
One update on that from Danger Room. Pentagon stunned by threat to close crucial base. However, we're going to jump to Think Progress. But staying on the topic of Afghanistan, where a military official says, we don't really have an end game in Afghanistan. President Obama's final, again, remember this is coming from Think Progress. They do great work, however, it's interesting to watch the mental gymnastics for Obama. President Obama is finalizing a plan to send tens of thousands of more troops to Afghanistan as, quote, part of a push to beat back the resurgent Taliban and secure regions of Afghanistan that are beyond the reach of the weak central government in Kabul. NBC's military correspondent Jim Mikliszewski reports that Pentagon officials haven't been able to provide an answer to Obama's concerns about having an endgame strategy in place. According to military officials, during last week's meeting with Defense Secretary Robert Gates and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon's tank, the president specifically asked, "What's the endgame in the U.S. military strategy for Afghanistan?" When asked what the answer was, one military official told NBC News, "Frankly, we don't have one. But they're working on it." New York Times reported recently, quote, "Even as Mr. Obama's military planners prepare for the first wave of the new Afghan surge, there is growing debate, including among those who agree with the plan to send more troops, about whether or how the troops can accomplish their mission and just what that mission is." Ask yourself that. Links in there to the aforementioned New York Times, as well as deepbackground.msnbc and the Wall Street Journal. We don't have an endgame in Afghanistan. However, as I've mentioned here before, guys like Robert Gates, backed by string puller Brzezinski, they know how to keep insurgencies going. Hit up Robert Gates on historycommons.org and just look at his timeline. And this is the guy that our change agent is going to leave in charge. More from Danger Room. Iran launches its first satellite. There's some raw video as well as things I can't understand. The clip is there for you, though. Iran says it sent a domestically built satellite into orbit. It's a troubling development if true. Much of the gear and the know-how behind a space launch can also be used for ballistic missiles. That's the bad news. The good news is that Tehran has a long, colorful history of trying to BS the world about their military capabilities. The OMID, HOPE, satellite was allegedly sent into space on top of a two-stage, 72-foot-long, 26-ton Safir Messenger rocket, which uses a modified version of Iran's most advanced ballistic missile system, the Shahab-3, as its first stage. The Arms Control Association believes a liquid-fueled second stage and possibly a small, solid-fueled third stage may follow. The New York Times notes and links in there to armscontrol.org as well as France24.com. They're basically saying Iran doesn't have the hardware possibly to do this. And it's the posturing and the back and the forth and the fear-mongering about, oh God, Iran. Oh God. The Chaniac attack on Iran ain't gonna happen. I believe that ship has sailed. However, from Iran, from PressTV.ir, no U.S.-Pakistan deal on drone attacks. Pakistan denies reports that Islamabad had clinched a secret deal with Washington allowing drone attacks inside the country's tribal zones. Pakistani Foreign Ministry spokesman Mohammad Sadiq said on Wednesday that, quote, "there is no understanding between Pakistan and the United States on predator attacks." His comments came in response to the remarks of U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in his testimony before the Senate Armed Forces Committee, who said Washington would continue strikes on Pakistan and Islamabad was aware of it. We're going to keep killing civilians with drones, and the puppet government knows about it, and we're going to keep doing it because it's a part of the new Brzezinski encirclement strategy. Playing both ends against the middle, all aiming towards Russia and possibly China. bringing it back home to Oregon with a strange tale. Two different stories posted up. CIA, criminals in action. Spies like U.S. and Algerian rape. The first story from the Washington Times, as well as tons of other national and international press. Jailed CIA spy enlisted his son to collect from Russian and other agents. This father and son, CIA crime spy duo, they hatched this, of course, out of Oregon. Even after becoming the highest-ranking CIA agent ever convicted of espionage, Harold James Nicholson continued running spy games, prosecutors say. In fact, according to an indictment unsealed last Thursday, Nicholson made it a family affair. Nicholson, 58, and his 24-year-old son, Nathaniel James Nicholson, are accused of hatching an operation from the elder man's prison cell, where he is currently serving a 23-year prison sentence after pleading guilty in 97 to selling secrets to the Russian government. According to prosecutors, the younger Mr. Nicholson was dispatched to Mexico, Peru, and Cyprus to collect money the Russians still owed his father. Prosecutors said he ultimately collected about $35,000 and also passed info on to the Russians, none of which was known to be classified. This is an amazing case, said David Ian Miller, special agent in charge of the FBI in Oregon. Harold James Nicholson, a convicted spy, was allowed to serve time in a federal prison in Oregon to be near his family. Without regret, he used that proximity to his family to continue contact with the foreign country for which he was previously convicted of spying.
When he pleaded guilty in 1997 to selling secrets to the Russians, Harold James Nicholson was the highest-ranking CIA official ever convicted of espionage. He was sentenced to 23 years in prison. But now the government says that did not end Nicholson's covert dealings with Russian agents. Nicholson and his son, Nathaniel James Nicholson, were charged today with 7 counts of conspiracy, money laundering, and acting as agents for a foreign government in an ongoing scheme the elder Nicholson directed from behind prison walls. An indictment unsealed today alleges that Nicholson and his son met numerous times between 2006 and 2008 inside the Federal Correctional Institution in Sheridan, Oregon. From there, the younger Nicholson was dispatched to multiple liaisons with Russian agents in San Francisco, Mexico City, Lima, Peru, and Cyprus, where he collected more than $35,000. The government claims the money, payments for the father's past spying, was then spread around to Nicholson family members. Court documents say the son and his Russian contacts used simple email codes to arrange their meetings. One of them, for example, read, "It looks like I will still be able to go on that vacation." The government believes the Russians continued the meetings to gain information about the 1996 arrest of the elder Nicholson, shown in the back of this police car.
Sources say it doesn't appear that any new sensitive information was actually passed along. Still, the new charges mean the Nicholsons, father and son, could now each face up to 100 years in prison if convicted. Bob Orr, CBS News, Washington.
Father and son spies, jailed in Sheridan, Oregon, still running around being gangsters on the low level of the pyramid. So, CIA, criminals in action. That was the spies like us. Here's the darker tale. CIA chief in Algeria accused of rape. From the Deutsche Press Agency, the CIA station chief in Algeria is under investigation for allegedly drugging and raping at least 2 Muslim women, ABC News reported last Wednesday, citing U.S. law enforcement sources. The probe was launched after 2 purported victims came forward with the allegations, and the agent was subsequently ordered to return home pending the outcome of the Justice Department investigation. U.S. officials would not confirm the identity of the station chief or comment on specifics of the case. Quote, "The U.S. takes very seriously any accusations of misconduct involving any U.S. personnel abroad," State Department Deputy Spokesman Robert Woods said in a statement last Wednesday. The individual in question has returned to Washington, and the U.S. government is looking into the matter. According to ABC, the two women told U.S. federal investigators sent to Algeria that on separate occasions, the 41-year-old station chief brought them back to his residence where they were drugged before being sexually assaulted. U.S. authorities obtained a warrant to search the agent's CIA-provided residence and discovered more than a dozen videotapes showing the officer engaged in sexual activity with women. The tapes led the Justice Department to widen the investigation to Egypt, where the agent was stationed before Algeria.
Breaking this morning, explosive charges against a former CIA station chief. He is accused of raping women while working overseas for the U.S. government. Our Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr is working this developing story. Barbara, what do we know so far?
Well, John, a source familiar with the investigation has confirmed to CNN that the former station chief in Algeria is under investigation by the Justice and State Departments for allegations of raping two women. Now, a government affidavit only identifies Andrew Warren as an employee of the U.S. Embassy in Algiers, but his identity was separately confirmed to us by sources. According to the affidavit, Warren told investigators that he had consensual sex with two women, but there is extended discussion in this affidavit of the two women making allegations that they were forced against their will and that they believe date rape drugs were used. A search of his apartment in Algiers did discover pills believed to be associated with date rape activity. According to the affidavit, it all remains under investigation.
So it's just under investigation at this point? He hasn't been arrested or detained in any way?
As far as we know, according to the affidavit, it remains under investigation. He is back in the United States and told not to return to Algeria. The matter continues to be reviewed. Tom.
Barbara Starr for us at the Pentagon this morning with the latest. Barbara, thanks. Just into CNN, our Suzanne Malveaux has been working her sources and just got reaction from the White House on this. She joins us now live. And Suzanne, you know, last week we saw that stress, or in the last week we saw that big address from, the interview with President Obama reaching out to the Muslim world. This has got to sting a bit.
Well, absolutely, John. I just spoke with Secretary Robert Gibbs about this. I asked him if he knew about the case. Obviously, he did know about this very hot case. He said that they were very much aware of it at the White House and that they take this very, very seriously. He said details obviously coming out of the Justice Department. But I followed up and I asked him, was he concerned? President Obama obviously making this effort to reach out to the Muslim community to establish a different kind of tone and respect. And he said, look, he understands, you know, this is something that took place back in October. This is something that they are following. They're watching very closely. But he says that he believes the president has made it very clear in that interview that he had with Al Arabiya that this is a new time and that these kinds of things are not going to be tolerated, obviously, that he wants to work with the Muslim community, with the Muslim world. And that is a message that he hopes is not going to be undercut by these kind of reports and these kind of events, because obviously you think about Abu Ghraib and some of the more the serious things that have happened over time. And you wonder, you know, just one incident, can that actually have a huge impact when it comes to how the Muslim world and folks are looking at this administration? So they're following the case very, very closely.
Yeah, and then the surface of Lisa looks like another black eye for the United States.
As a new president makes an effort to reach out to the Muslim world, it is not the kind of news he needs. The CIA station chief in a Muslim nation, Algeria, is under investigation, accused of raping Muslim women. The allegations would be shocking at any time, anywhere, but coming now, and in that part of the world, they could have a profound impact. Our chief investigative correspondent, Brian Ross, is here tonight. Brian?
Charlie, U.S. law enforcement officials tell ABC News the CIA's top man in Algiers allegedly laced the drinks of his victims and then made secret videos of the sex acts.
It was just last year that the U.S. opened a new embassy in Algiers. And the new U.S. ambassador, David Pierce, presented his credentials to the Algerian government. But now what appeared to be a new high in the relationship between the two countries could be in jeopardy. U.S. law enforcement officials tell ABC News the CIA station chief in Algiers, Andrew Warren, a 41-year-old convert to Islam himself, has been accused of rape by two Algerian women, and Warren has been ordered out of the country by the U.S. ambassador. According to an affidavit filed in federal court that names Warren, the women, independent of each other, both said they felt the violent onset of nausea after consuming drinks prepared by Warren at U.S. Embassy social events. One, says the affidavit, woke up the next morning. She was lying on a bed, completely nude, with no memory of how she had been undressed, and realized she recently had engaged in sexual intercourse, though she had no memory of having intercourse. The second alleged victim said she felt physically paralyzed and asked Warren to stop, but then he reportedly replied, "Nobody stays in my expensive sheets with clothes on." U.S. officials are bracing for the reaction from the Muslim world.
Because it has to do with the incredibly sensitive issue of rape of an American, of a CIA operative, raping a Muslim woman.
Warren, an author with his own website, has been with the CIA since 2001, and in Algiers, was responsible for coordinating with Algerian intelligence services in the fight against an Al-Qaeda wing there that has carried out a series of bombings. Officials say among the items recovered in a search of his Algiers residence were more than a dozen videos that appear to have been secretly recorded, showing Warren engaged in sex acts with a number of women, including one of the alleged victims. Also discovered, the drugs Xanax and Valium, which the affidavit says are commonly used as date rape drugs.
Warren did not return repeated calls we left with his family, but investigators say he claims the sex was consensual. As for the CIA, it has refused to acknowledge the investigation, although a spokesman said any such allegations would be taken seriously and followed up on. Charlie,
what do we know about the status of the investigation?
Law enforcement officials tell us, Charlie, the investigation is proceeding at full steam, and the prosecutors could present the case to a federal grand jury in Washington soon. They also say it has broadened beyond Algiers. The videos that were recovered show date stamps, which indicate some of these acts may have taken place in Warren's previous posting in Cairo, Egypt.
All right, Ryan Ross, our chief investigative reporter.
CIA chief in Algeria accused of rape. That, along with the father and son Oregon CIA spies, wraps up that CIA criminals in action posting. However, even though he's out of office, only been gone a couple weeks, Cheney, in a new and his first post-office interview, was with Politico.com and Mike Allen. In the interview, Cheney said that hundreds of thousands could be killed in a new attack. The former vice president believes that President Obama's policies make an attack more likely.
2 weeks out of office, the former Vice President Dick Cheney is already suggesting the new administration may not necessarily be up to the task of protecting Americans against a catastrophic terror attack. We've asked Brian Todd to look into the story for us. Pretty stunning comments from Dick Cheney. What exactly did he say that's causing this kind of uproar?
Really getting on this administration for its readiness to handle a terrorist attack. Wolf, the time and content of Dick Cheney's remarks very surprising. Now a little more free to speak his mind, he unloads on the terror threat and the ability of this White House to handle it.
Senate will be in order, please.
In striking, blunt language, Dick Cheney gives a chilling threat assessment. In an interview with Politico, the former vice president warns there's a high probability that terrorists will try to use the world's most destructive weapons against the United States.
A nuclear weapon or a biological agent of some kind. The potential ability of an Al-Qaeda organization, an Al-Qaeda group, to get their hands on that kind of weapon and deploy it in the middle of one of our own cities. That's the ultimate threat service.
How does Cheney think the new administration is handling the threat?
When we get people who are more concerned with reading the rights to an Al-Qaeda terrorist than they are with protecting the United States against people who are absolutely committed to do everything they can to kill Americans, then I worry.
Who precisely in the Obama administration would be more concerned about reading Al-Qaeda its rights than protecting the U.S. against terrorists, Cheney never mentioned. Cheney called Guantanamo a first-class program, said protecting the country is a, quote, tough, mean, dirty, nasty business. He didn't single out President Obama personally, but suggested there's a naive mindset in the current administration. Contacted by CNN, the White House wouldn't comment. Analyst David Gergen says it's understandable for Cheney to defend his own record, but says he may be prejudging the president.
He has said, yes, he wants to close down Guantanamo, but he wants to wait a year, up to a year, to figure out how to do it. He's not rushing into or willy-nilly trying to close down and let people free.
Still, Cheney didn't reveal any doubts about the policies he was associated with as vice president, saying if it hadn't been for enhanced interrogation or the surveillance program, quote, we would have been attacked again.
Well, speaking his mind, the former vice president, I suspect he's going to be doing a lot more.
Right, not retiring into the shadows.
No, not by any means. Thanks very much, Brian, for that.
Why does it help Dick Cheney politically for him to be scary?
Well, I don't think there's much of a mystery about that. If you look at things that politicians and political scientists, historians have said, even the founders of this country have pointed out many, many times, there's really no more effective weapon for a government to keep a citizenry in submission to whatever it wants than keeping the fear level as high as possible. And that's essentially been the linchpin of the Bush administration for the last 8 years, what you've just been yelling through that megaphone, which is that unless you submit to the powers that we want, you will be attacked by very frightening terrorists. And I think what's so vital to point out is that if you look at American history, the most disgraceful and regrettable acts, the acts that most people consider to be quite awful that we've done in our history, haven't been because we've been insufficiently aggressive about dealing with external threats. It's been the opposite. It's because we've allowed the government to exaggerate external threats and drive us to embrace very radical overreactions, whether it's the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II, or the McCarthyite witch hunts of the 1950s, or the censorship laws in the late 18th century, or even at the end of World War I. It's Dick Cheney fear-mongering that has driven us to do the things that we end up regret doing, and it's the responsibility of the citizenry not to let a government do that.
Threataganda from beyond the White House. Cheney threatens hundreds of thousands could die in a new 9/11 terror attack. Links in there to Cryptagon, as well as more from YouTube and more clips in thinkprogress.org and Politico. And of course, reading about Cheney on the complete 9/11 timeline on historycommons.org. It was nice to see a op-ed blog piece on the Swampland blog on Time to Dick Cheney from Joe Klein. Dick Cheney, please go away. However, like you heard in there, Glenn Greenwald on the Rachel Maddow show, talking about Cheney, talking about his threataganda, trying to say he's going to set up Obama. Greenwald says Cheney setting up Obama in case of terror attack, and trying to break down what exactly the threataganda is about. I think, again, that probably the Cheneys of the world are on their way out. And these guys, these specters, will pop up from time to time. But there's new gangsters in town calling some shots. We're going to wrap up this B-side episode of 109 of MediaMonarchy.com with a little taste of a bit more of what 110 is going to be like. Always trying when I can to put the media back into the monarchy. Excellent news. David Letterman finally played the censored last appearance of Bill Hicks. Brought to my attention from undercoverblackman.blogspot.com. If you're a stand-up comedy fan or a student of pop culture more largely, something happened last Friday that you should know about. Bill Hicks, who died of metastatic cancer 15 years ago, performed on The Late Show with David Letterman. The comedy routine was taped in October 1993, but it was never shown until last Friday night. Letterman accepted blame for banning the performance in the first place, and he apologized to Bill Hicks's mother face-to-face. She's the guest there. The censoring of Bill Hicks by Letterman, who had been his biggest champion, was a major event in Hicks's legendary life. Letterman didn't know at the time that Hicks had pancreatic cancer and would be dead within months. When he passed at the age of 32, Hicks had secured a reputation as the most groundbreaking, risk-taking American satirist since George Carlin. So, watch this amazing set, and we'll hear Letterman's comments at the beginning and the end. And again, undercoverblackman.blogspot.com asks and says that you're bound to imagine, again, what the Bush years would have been like with Bill Hicks still around. So, here it is. The censored last appearance of Bill Hicks on The Letterman Show.
Here we go. So this will be now October 1st, 1993, and I think it's safe to say that some of the references now, I mean, 16 years ago, are not going to seem perhaps all that contemporary, but I'll bet it'll just be fine. You must have seen the videotape, right? It's not the first time you've seen it.
No.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it recently.
Yeah. And when you see it,
You must be very happy and pleased to have seen it, and sad also, obviously.
Really? I mean, I'm all of that.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to take a look here tonight, and I want you folks to enjoy this, honestly. Here he is now doing stand-up comedy on this stage in a segment that I had taken out of our program October 1st, 1993. Here's the very funny Bill Hicks.
Thank you. Good evening. Very excited to be here tonight, and got some great news today. I finally got my own TV show coming out as a replacement show this fall. Yeah. Thank you. It's not a talk show. Don't worry. It's a half-hour weekly show that I will host entitled Let's Hunt and Kill Billy Ray Cyrus. Thank you. It's fairly self-explanatory. Each week we let the hounds of hell loose. We chase that jarhead, no-talent, cracker idiot all over the globe. Till I finally catch that fruity little ponytail of his, pull him to his knees, put a shotgun in his mouth. Then we'll be back in 94. Let's hunt and kill Michael Bolton. Also look out for our Vanilla Ice, MC Hammer, Marky Mark Christmas special. And, I don't want to give away any surprises, but Marky Mark's the first one we catch and kill on that show because his pants kept falling around his ankles and he couldn't run away. I crossbow him right in the ass. Bring the whole kids, the family, and everything. It's a Christmas spectacular. I don't know what my deal is. I'm like a 31-year-old curmudgeon. That's the deal. You know, I went to a dance club the other day, you know, and dragged against my will, you know. And this girl asked me to dance, which I thought was hilarious, you know. Would you like to dance? You know, I'm like, yeah, you read my mind, you know. That's why I'm leaning in the darkest corner closest to the exit, you know. I'm about to boogie. I'm about to cut a rug. It's weird. Women have this weird myth. You can tell the way a guy is in bed by how he is on a dance floor. I think that's ridiculous. What does it matter? You know what I mean? If a guy is on a dance floor, really getting into it, enjoying himself, expressing himself, what does it matter how he is in bed? He's gay. Real men don't dance. They sit, sweat, and curse. Speaking of homosexuality, you know, I consider myself fairly open-minded, but something has come to my attention I find absolutely shocking. I don't know if you've heard about it. These new grade school books for children to teach them gay lifestyles. You know what I'm talking about? One of them is called Heather's Two Mommies. The other is called Daddy's New Roommate. I'm going to have to draw the line here, folks, and say this is absolutely disgusting. Okay? It is grotesque and evil. I'm talking about Daddy's New Roommate. Heather's Two Mommies is pretty cool. I don't know if you'll check that out. They're hugging on page 7. Oh, go mommies, go, go. Anyway, it makes me miss my youth. People annoy me. You know what's really annoying me? These pro-life people. You ever look at their faces? I'm pro-life. Why don't they look it? They just exude joie de vivre, you know? You see them trying to go to an orphanage and adopt a kid. We're pro-life, we're here to adopt. Kids are just, oh, don't pick me. Oh, no. I'll eat gruel, 15 to a bed, no problem. Just keep Heather's Two Mommies coming and we're fine in here. I'm pro-life. You know, if you're really pro-life, do me a favor. Don't lock arms and block med clinics, okay? If you're so pro-life, do me a favor. Lock arms and block cemeteries, okay? Let's see how committed you are to this idea. She can't come in. She was 98. She was hit by a bus. There's options. Are we going to have her stuffed? What are we going to do with her? We're pro-life. That's the same look smokers give you, too. I'm a non-smoker. I'm a pro-life non-smoker. I'm getting that look a lot these days because I started smoking again, and I had 9 months without a cigarette, and I started again, and I'm getting that look. Are you applauding me starting or stopping? What are you? The smokers are, hey, you're back.
non-smokers. It's terrible. I can't believe he started again. Why? After 9 months.
I have this belief. If that scenario is at all true, when you die and you go to heaven and St. Peter meets you at the gate, I have this belief, the first thing he's going to ask you is, you got a light? You mean y'all smoke here? Yeah, that's why it's heaven. These aren't clouds. This is cigarette smoke, pal. Hell is a non-smoking section. You want to look at them for a minute? Okay. I can't believe what they do to their bodies. It's so smelly. It smells like an ashtray. Why do they want me to smell that? God, that's hellish. Exactly. Light up and come on in. Hendrix is on harp tonight. So I've been traveling. I was in Australia over Easter, which was interesting to note. They celebrate Easter the same way we do, commemorating the death and resurrection of Jesus by telling our children a giant bunny rabbit left chocolate eggs in the night. I wonder why we're messed up as a race. Anybody got any clues? I've read the Bible. Can't find the word bunny or chocolate anywhere in the book. Why those two things? Why not, you know, goldfish left Lincoln logs in your sock drawer? You know, just making stuff up. Go hog wild. But I think it's interesting to note how people act on religious beliefs. You know what I mean? Like a lot of Christians wear crosses around their necks. Nice sentiment. But you think when Jesus comes back, he's really going to want to look at a cross? Hell, that may be why he hasn't shown up yet. He's going, man, they're still wearing crosses, Dad. I'm not going. No, they totally missed the point. I'm not going. Forget it. I'll go back as a bunny. But
just great. He looks tremendous. And I've not seen that videotape or any part of it since that night. And seeing it now, it raises the question, what was the matter with me? What was I thinking? That was just tremendous. He if anything... It says a great deal about me. It says more about me as a guy than it says about Bill, because there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. Just perfect. And the fact that, and I expected it to be somewhat dated, being that old, and it's not. It's just great. In fact, I guess this speaks to the suggestion that he was way ahead of his time. Mary, this has been a good night for me, and I hope a good night for you.
It's been a very good night.
God bless you.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you. We'll be right back with the Gaslight Anthem, everybody.
The late, great, amazing Bill Hicks. That clip, as well as parts 1 and 2, where Dave's just there talking to Bill Hicks's mom last Friday on Late Night with David Letterman. Letterman finally plays the censored last appearance of Bill Hicks. I believe that'll set the stage, like I said, for the more media-memed episode 110 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. Thanks for listening. Thanks for spreading the word. Thanks for getting in touch with me. You can hit, as you know, the podcast and all that. MediaMonarchy.com. MediaMonarchy@Yahoo.com. IM, Skype, Facebook, MySpace, YouTube, all of it. Spread the word, and we'll keep putting the puzzle together. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight. Yo.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.